he'd gotten a candid mistress. She sensibly told him what all his adoration of her meant, told him that he was no more himself with her than Dawn was Dawn at the psychiatric clinic, explained to him that he was out to sabotage everything. But he was in such a state that he went on anyway telling her how, when they ran away together to Ponce, she could learn Spanish and teach techniques of speech therapy at the university there, and he could operate the business from his Ponce plant, and they could live in a modern hacienda up in the hills among the palms above the Caribbean. What she didn't tell him about was Mary in her house after the bombing. Mary hiding in her house. She told him everything except that. The candor stopped just where it should have begun. Was everyone's brain as unreliable as his? Was he the only one unable to see what people were up to? Did everyone slip around the way he did, in and out 100 different times a day, go from being smart to being smart enough to being as dumb as the next guy to being the dumbest bastard who ever lived? Was it stupidity deforming him, the simpleton son of a simpleton father? Or was life just one big deception that everyone was onto, except him? This sense of inadequacy he might once have described to her. He could talk to Sheila, talk about his doubts, his bewilderment. All the serenity in her allowed for that, this magician of a woman who had given Mary the great opportunity that Mary had thrown away, who had supplanted with a wonderful floating feeling, according to Mary, half at least of her stutterer's frustration, the lucid woman whose profession was to give sufferers a second chance, the mistress who knew everything, including how to harbor a murderer. Sheila had been with Mary, and she had told him nothing. All the trust between them, like all the happiness he'd ever known, like the killing of Fred Conlon, like everything, had been an accident. She'd been with Mary and said nothing. And said nothing now. The eagerness with which others spoke seemed, under the peculiar intensity of her gaze, to strike her as a branch of pathology. Why would anyone say that? She herself was to say nothing all evening, nothing about Linda Lovelace or Richard Nixon or H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, her advantage over other people being that her head was not filled by what filled everybody else's head. This way of hers, of lying in wait behind herself, this we'd at once taken to be a mark of her superiority. Now he thought, icy bitch. Why? Once she had said to him, the influence you allow others to have on you, it's absolute. Nothing so captivates you as another person's needs. And he had said, I think you're describing Sheila Salzman. And as always, he was wrong. He thought she was omniscient, and all she was cold. Whirling about inside him now was a frenzied distrust of everyone. The excision of certain assurances, the last assurances, made him feel as though he had gone in one day from being 5 to being 100. It would give him comfort, he thought. It would help him right then if, of all things, he knew that resting out in the pasture beyond their dinner table was Dawn's herd, with Count, the big bull, protecting them. If Dawn still had Count, if only Count, a relief-filled, reality-less moment passed before he realized that of course it would be a comfort to have Count roaming the dark pasture among the cows, because then Mary would be roaming among the guests here, Mary, in her circus pajamas, leaning up against the back of her father's chair, whispering into her father's ear, Mrs. Orcutt drinks whiskey. Mrs. Umanoff has B.O. Dr. Salzman is bald. A mischievous intelligence that was utterly harmless, back then unanarchic and childish, and well within bounds. Meanwhile, he heard himself saying, Dad, take some more steak, in what he knew was a hopeless effort, a good son's effort, to get his self-abandoned father to be, if not tranquil, less insistently chagrined over the inadequacies of the non-Jewish human race. I'll tell you who I'll take some steak for this young lady. Spearing a slice from the platter that one of the serving girls was holding beside him, he dumped it onto Jesse's plate. He had taken Jesse on as a full-scale project. Now, pick up your knife and fork and eat, he told her. You could use some red meat. Sit up straight. And as though she believed he could well resort to violence if she did otherwise, Jesse Orcutt drunkenly mumbled, "I was going to," but began to fiddle with the meat in such a clumsy way that the Swede feared his father was going to start cutting her food for her. All that crude energy, try as it might, could not remake the trouble world. But this is serious business, this children business. Having gotten Jesse taking nourishment, he was in a state again about deep throat. If that isn't serious, what is anymore? Dad, said the Swede, what Shelley is saying is not that it's not serious. He agrees it's serious. He's saying that once you've made your case to an adolescent child, you've made your case and you can't then take these kids and lock them up in their rooms and throw away the key. His daughter was an insane murderer hiding on the floor of a room in Newark. His wife had a lover who dry-humped her over the sink in their family kitchen. His ex-mistress had knowingly brought disaster upon his house, and he was trying to propitiate his father with on the one hand this and on the other hand that. You'd be surprised, Shelley told the old man, how much the kids today have learned to take in their stride. But degrading things should not be taken in their stride. I say lock them in their rooms if they take this in their stride. I remember when kids used to be at home doing their homework and not out seeing movies like this. This is the morality of a country that we're talking about. Well, isn't it? Am I nuts? It's an affront to decency and to decent people. And what, Marcia asked him, is so inexhaustibly interesting about decency? The question so surprised him that it left him looking a little frantically around the table for somebody with an opinion learned enough to subdue this woman. It turned out to be Orcutt, that great friend of the family. Bill Orcutt was coming to Lulavov's aid. And what is wrong with decency? Orcutt asked, smiling broadly at Marcia. The Swede couldn't look at him. On top of all the things he couldn't think about, there were two people, Sheila and Orcutt, he could not look at. Did Dawn consider Bill Orcutt handsome? He never thought so. Round face, snout nose, puckering lower lip. Piggy-looking bastard. Must be something else that drove it to that frenzy over the kitchen sink. What? The easy assurance? Was that what got it going? The comfort taken by Bill Orcutt in being Bill Orcutt? His contentment in being Bill Orcutt? Was it because he wouldn't dream of slighting you, even if both you and he knew that you weren't up to snuff? Was it his appropriateness that got her going like that? The flawless appropriateness? How very appropriately he played his role as steward of the Morris County past? Was it the sense he exuded of never having had to grub for anything? Or take shit from anyone? Or be at a loss as to how to behave even when the wife on his arm was a hopeless drunk? Was it because he'd entered the world expecting things not even a Wickwake Three Letterman begins to expect? That none of us begin to expect? That the rest of us, even if we get those things by working our asses off for them, still never feel entitled to? Was that why she was in heat over the sink? Because of his inbred sense of entitlement? Or was it the laudable environmentalism? Or was it the great art? Or was it simply his cock? Is that it, Dawn, dear? I want an answer. I want it tonight. Is it just his cock? The Swede could not stop imagining the particulars of Orcutt fucking his wife any more than he could stop imagining the particulars of the rapist fucking his daughter. Tonight, the imagining would not let him be. Decency? Marcia said to Orcutt, foxily smiling back at him. Much overvalued, wouldn't you say? The seductions of decency and civility and convention. Not the richest response to life I can think of. So what do you recommend for richness, Orcutt asked her? The high road of transgression? The patrician architect was amused by the literature professor and the menacing figure she tried to cut in order to appall the squares. Amused he was, amused. But the Swede couldn't turn the dinner party into a battle for his wife. Things were bad enough without colliding with Orcutt in front of his parents. All he had to do was to not listen to him. Yet each time that Orcutt spoke, every word antagonized him, convulsed him with spite and hatred and sinister thoughts. And when Orcutt wasn't speaking, the Swede was constantly looking down the table to see what in God's name there was in that face that could so excite his wife. Well, Marcia was saying, without transgression, there isn't very much knowledge, is there? My God, cried Lulavov, that's one I never heard before. Excuse me, Professor, but where the hell do you get that idea? The Bible, said Marcia deliciously, for a start. The Bible? Which Bible? The one that begins with Adam and Eve. Isn't that what they tell us in Genesis? Isn't that what the Garden of Eden story is telling us? What? Telling us what? Without transgression, there is no knowledge. Well, that ain't what they taught me, he replied, about the Garden of Eden. But then I never got past the eighth grade. What did they teach you, Lou? That when God above tells you not to do something, you damn well don't do it. That's what. Do it, and you pay the piper. Do it, and you will suffer from it for the rest of your days. Obey the good Lord above, said Marcia, and all the terrible things will vanish. Well, yes, he replied, though without conviction, realizing that he was being mocked. Look, we are way off the subject. We are not talking about the Bible. Forget the Bible. This is no place to talk about the Bible. We are talking about a movie where a grown woman, from all reports, goes in front of a movie camera and for money, openly, for millions and millions of people to see, children, everyone, does everything she can think of that is degrading. That's what we're talking about. Degrading to whom? Marcia asked him. To her, for God's sakes. Number one, her. She has made herself into the scum of the earth. You can't tell me you're in favor of that. She hasn't made herself into the scum of anything, Lou. To the contrary, said Orchid, laughing. She has eaten of the tree of knowledge. And, announced Marcia, made herself into a superstar. The highest of the high. I think Miss Lovelace is having the time of her life. Adolf Hitler had the time of his life, Professor, shoveling Jews into the furnace. That does not make it right. This is a woman who is poisoning young minds, poisoning the country, and in the bargain, she is making herself the scum of the earth, period. There was nothing inactive in Lou Lvov when he argued, and it looked as though just observing the phenomenon of an opinionated old man fettered still to his fantasy of the world was all that was prompting Marcia to persist, to bait and bite and draw blood. Her sport. The Swede wanted to kill her. Leave him alone. Leave him alone, and he'll shut up. It's no big deal getting him to say more and more and more, so stop it. But this problem that he had so long ago learned to circumnavigate, in part by subduing his own personality, seemingly subjugating it to his father's while maneuvering around Lou where he could, the problem of the father, of maintaining filial love against the onslaught of an unrelenting father, was not a problem that she had decades of experience integrating into her life. Jerry just told their father to fuck off. Dawn was driven almost crazy by him, and Sylvia Lvov stoically and impatiently endured him, her only successful form of resistance being to freeze him out and live with the isolation, and see more of herself evaporating year by year. But Marcia took him on as the fool he was, for still believing in the power of his indignation to convert the corruptions of the present into the corruptions of the past. So what would you want her to be instead, Lou? A cocktail waitress? Marcia asked. Why not? That's a job. Not much of one, Marcia replied. Not one that would interest anyone here. Oh, said Lou Lvov. They'd prefer what she does instead. I don't know, said Marcia. We'll have to poll the girls. Which would you prefer, she said to Sheila, cocktail waitress or porn star? But Sheila wasn't about to be engulfed in Marcia's mockery. And with eyes that seemed to stare past it and right on through to the egotism, she gave her unequivocal reply. The Swede remembered that after Sheila had first met Marcia and Barry Yamanov here at the old Rimrock house, he had asked her, how can he love this person? And instead of answering him as Dawn did, because he's a ballless wonder, Sheila had replied, by the end of a dinner party, everybody is probably thinking that about somebody. Sometimes everybody is thinking that about everybody. Do you? He asked her. I think that about couples all the time, she said. The wise woman. And yet, this wise woman had harbored a murderer. What about Dawn? Marcia asked. Cocktail waitress or porno actress? Smiling sweetly, exhibiting her best Catholic schoolgirl posture, the girl who makes the nuns happy by sitting at her desk without slouching, Dawn said, up yours, Marcia. What kind of conversation is this? Lou Lvov asked. A dinner conversation, Sylvia Lvov replied. And what makes you so blasé? He asked her. I'm not blasé, I'm listening. Now, Bill Orcutt said, nobody's polled you, Marcia. Which would you prefer, assuming you had the choice? She laughed merrily at the sliding innuendo. Oh, they've got big fat mamas in dirty movies. They too appear in the dreams of men. And not only for comic relief. Listen, you folks are too hard on Linda. Why is it that if a girl takes off her clothes in Atlantic City, it's for a scholarship, and makes her an American goddess, but if she takes off her clothes in a sex flick, it's for filthy money and makes her a whore. Why is that? Why? All right, nobody knows, but seriously, folks, I love this word, scholarship. A hooker comes to a hotel room. The guy asks her how much she gets. She says, well, if you want blank, I get a $300 scholarship. And if you want blank, blank, I get a $500 scholarship. And if you want blank, 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 Marcia, said Daunt, try as you will. You can't get under my skin tonight. Can't I? Not tonight. There was a beautiful floral arrangement at the center of the table. From Dawn's garden, Lulavov had told them all proudly as they were sitting down to eat. There were also large platters of the beefsteak tomatoes sliced thickly, dressed in oil and vinegar, and encircled by slices of red onion fresh from the garden. And there were two wooden buckets, old feed buckets, that they picked up at a junk shop in Clinton for $1 apiece, each lined gaily with a red bandana and brimming with the ears of corn that Orcutt had helped her shuck. Cradled in wicker baskets near either end of the table were freshly baked loaves of French bread, those new baguettes from McPherson's, reheated in the oven and pleasant to tear apart with your hands. And there was good, strong burgundy wine, half a dozen bottles of the Swede's best Pommard, four of them open on the table, bottles that 5 years back he had laid down for drinking in 1973, according to his wine register. Pommard laid down in his cellar just 1 month to the day before Mary killed Dr. Conlon. Yes, earlier in the evening, he had found 1368 inscribed in his handwriting in the spiral notebook he used for recording the details of each new purchase. 1368, he had written, with no idea that on 2368, his daughter would go ahead and outrage all of America, except perhaps for Professor Marcia Yumanoff. The two high school kids who were doing the serving emerged from the kitchen every few minutes, silently offering around the steaks he cooked, arranged on pewter platters, all carved up and running with blood. The sweet set of carving knives were from Hofritz, the best German stainless steel. He'd gone over to New York to buy the set and a big carving block for their first Thanksgiving in the old Rimrock house. He once had cared about all that stuff, loved to hone the blade on the long conical file before he went after the bird, loved the sound of it, the sad inventory of his domestic bounty, wanted his family to have the best, wanted his family to have everything. Please, said Lulava, can I get an answer about the effect of this on the children? You're all way, way off the topic. Haven't we seen enough tragedy with the young children, pornography, drugs, the violence? Divorce, Marcia threw in to help him out. Professor, don't get me started on divorce. You understand French? He asked her. I do if I have to, she said, laughing. Well, I got a son down in Florida, Seymour's brother, whose specialité is divorce. I thought his specialité was cardiac surgery, but no, it's divorce. I thought I sent them to medical school. I thought that's where all the bills were coming from, but no, it was divorce school. That's what he got the diploma in, divorce. Has there ever been a more terrible thing for a child than the specter of divorce? I don't think so. And where will it end? What is the limit? You didn't all grow up in that kind of world. Neither did I. We grew up in an era when it was a different place, when the feeling for community, home, family, parents were, well, it was different. The changes are beyond conception. I sometimes think that more has changed since 1945 than in all the years of history there have ever been. I don't know what to make of the end of so many things, the lack of feeling for individuals that a person sees in that movie, the lack of feeling for places like what is going on in Newark. How did this happen? You don't have to revere your family. You don't have to revere your country. You don't have to revere where you live, but you have to know you have them. You have to know that you're part of them, because if you don't, you're just out there on your own, and I feel for you. I honestly do. Am I right, Mr. Orcutt, or am I wrong? To wonder where the limit is? Orcutt replied. Well, yes, said Lulava, who, the Swede observed, and not for the first time, had spoken of children and violence without any sense that the subject intersected with the life of his immediate family. Mary had been used for somebody else's evil purposes. That was the story to which it was crucial for them all to remain anchored. He kept such a sharp watch over each and every one of them to be certain that nobody wavered for a moment in their belief in that story. No one in this family was going to fall into doubt about Mary's absolute innocence, not so long as he was alive. Among the many things the Swede couldn't think about from within the confines of his box, was what would happen to his father when he learned that the death toll was 4.
You're right, Bill Orcutt was saying to Lulabov, to wonder where the limit is.
I think everybody here is wondering where the limit is and worrying where the limit is every time they look at the papers. Except the professor of transgression. But then we're all stifled by convention. We're not great outlaws like William Burroughs and the Marquis de Sade and the holy saint Jean Genet. The let every man do whatever he wishes school of literature. The brilliant school of civilization is oppression and morality is worse. And he did not blush. Morality, without batting an eye. Transgression, as though he were a stranger to it, as though it were not he, of all the men here, William III, latest in that long line of Orcutts advertised in their graveyard as virtuous men, who had transgressed to the utmost by violating the unity of a family already half destroyed. His wife had a lover, and it was for the lover that she'd undergone the rigors of a facelift to woo and win him. Yes, now he understood the gushing letter profusely thanking the plastic surgeons for spending the 5 hours of your time for my beauty, thanking him as if the suite hadn't paid $12,000 for those 5 hours, plus $5,000 more for the clinic suite where they had spent the 2 nights. It is quite wonderful, dear doctor. It is as though I have been given a new life, both from within and from the outside. In Geneva, he had sat up with her all night, held her hand through the nausea and the pain, and all of it for the sake of somebody else. It was for the sake of somebody else that she was building the house. The two of them were designing the house for each other. To run away to Ponce to live with Sheila after Mary disappeared? No. Sheila had made him come to his senses and recover his rectitude and go back to his wife and as much of their life as remained intact. To the wife, even a mistress knew he couldn't wound, let alone desert in such a crisis. Yet these other two were going to pull it off. He knew it the moment he saw them in the kitchen. They're packed. Orcutt dumps Jessie, and she dumps me, and the house is for them. She thinks our catastrophe is over, and so she's going to bury the past and start anew. Face, house, husband, all new. Try as you will, you can't get under my skin tonight. Not tonight. They are the outlaws. Orcutt, said Dawn to her husband, live completely off what his family once was. Well, she was living off what she'd just become. Dawn and Orcutt, two predators. The outlaws are everywhere. They're inside the gates. He had a phone call. One of the girls came out of the kitchen to tell him. She whispered, it's from, I think, Czechoslovakia. He took the call in Dawn's downstairs study, where Orcutt had already moved the large cardboard model of the new house. After leaving Jesse on the terrace with the suite and his parents and the drinks, Orcutt must have gone back to the van to get the model and carried it into Dawn's study and set it up on her desk before proceeding into the kitchen to help her shuck the corn. Rita Cohen was on the line. She knew about Czechoslovakia because they were following him. They followed him earlier in the summer to the Czech consulate. They followed him that afternoon to the animal hospital. They followed him to Mary's room, where Mary had told him there was no such person as Rita Cohen. How can you do this to your own daughter? She asked. I've done nothing to my daughter. I went to see my daughter. You wrote and told me where she was. You told her about the hotel. You told her we didn't fuck. I did not mention any hotel. I don't know what this is all about. You are lying to me. You told your daughter you did not fuck me. I warned you about that. I warned you in the letter. Directly in front of the suite sat the model of the house. He could see now why he had not been able to envision from Dawn's explanations exactly how the long shed roof let the light into the main hallway through the high row of windows running the length of the front wall. Yes, Now he saw how the sun would arc through the southern sky, and the light would wash, and how happy it seemed to make her just to say, "Wash," after light. Wash over the white walls, thus changing everything for everyone. The cardboard roof was detachable, and when he lifted it up, he could look right into the rooms. All the interior walls were in place. There were doors and closets. In the kitchen, there were cabinets, a refrigerator, a dishwasher, a range. Walcott had gone so far as to install in the living room tiny pieces of furniture also fashioned out of cardboard, a library table by the western wall of windows, a sofa, end tables, an ottoman, two club chairs, a coffee table in front of a raised fireplace hearth that extended the width of the room. In the bedroom, across from the bay window, where there were the built-in drawers, shaker drawers, Dawn called them, was the large bed awaiting its two occupants. On the wall, to either side of the headboard, were built-in shelves for books. Orcutt had made some books and put them on the shelves, miniaturized books fashioned out of cardboard. They even had titles on them. He was good at all this. Better at this, thought the Swede, than at the painting. Yes, wouldn't life be so much less futile if we could do it at the scale of 1/16 inch to a foot? The only thing missing from the bedroom was a cardboard cock with Orcutt's name on it. Orcutt should have made a 1/16 inch scale model of Dawn on her stomach with her ass in the air and from behind his cock going in. It would have been nice for the Swede to have found that, too, while he stood over her desk looking down at Dawn's cardboard dreaming and absorbing the fury of Rita Cohen. What does Rita Cohen have to do with Jainism? What does one thing have to do with the other? No, Mary, it does not hang together. What does any of this ranting have to do with you, who will not even do harm to water? Nothing hangs together. None of it is linked up. It's only in your head that it's linked up. Nowhere else is there any logic. She's been tracking Mary, trailing her, tracing her, but they're not connected and they never were. There's the logic. You've gone too far. You go too far. You think you are running the show. Daddy, you are not running anything. But whether he was or wasn't running the show no longer mattered, because if Mary and Rita Cohen were connected in any way, if Mary had lied to him about not knowing Rita Cohen, then she might as easily have been lying about being taken in by Sheila after the bombing. If that was so, when Dawn and Orcutt ran off to live in this cardboard house, he and Sheila could run off to Puerto Rico after all. And if, as a result, his father dropped dead, well, they just have to bury him. That's what they do. Bury him deep in the ground. He was all at once remembering the death of his grandfather, what it did to his father. The Swede was a little kid, 7 years old. His grandfather had been rushed to the hospital the evening before, and his father and his uncles sat at the old man's bedside all night long. When his father arrived home, it was 7:30 in the morning. The Swede's grandfather had died. His father got out of the car, went as far as the front steps of the house, and then just sat himself down. The Swede watched him from behind the living room curtains. His father didn't move, even when the Swede's mother came out to comfort him. He sat without moving for over an hour, all the time leaning forward, his elbows on his knees and his face invisible in his hands. There was such a load of tears inside his head that he had to hold it like that in his two strong hands to prevent it from tumbling off of him. When he was able to raise the head up again, he got back in the car and drove to work. Is Mary lying? Is Mary brainwashed? Is Mary a lesbian? Is Rita the girlfriend? Is Mary running the whole insane thing? Are they out to do nothing but torture me? Is that the game, the entire game, to torture and torment me? No, Mary is not lying. Mary is right. Rita Cohen does not exist. If Mary believes it, I believe it. He did not have to listen to somebody who did not exist. The drama she constructed did not exist. Her hateful accusations did not exist. Her authority did not exist. Her power. If she did not exist, she could not have any power. Could Mary have these religious beliefs and Rita Cohen? You had only to listen to Rita Cohen howling into the phone to know that she was someone to whom there was no sacred form of life on earth or in heaven. What does she have to do with self-starvation and Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King? She does not exist because she does not fit in. These are not even her words. These are not a young girl's words. There are no grounds for these words. This is an imitation of someone. Someone has been telling her what to do and what to say. From the beginning, this has all been an act. She's an act. She didn't arrive at this by herself. Someone is behind her. Someone corrupt and cynical and distorted who sets these kids to do these things, who strips a Rita Cohen and a Mary LaVeouf of everything good that was their inheritance and lures them into this act. You are going to take back all your dopey pleasures? Take her from her holiness into that shallow, soulless excuse for life? Yours is the lowest species on this earth. Don't you know that yet? Are you really able to believe that you, with your conception of life, you basking unpunished in the crime of your wealth, have anything whatsoever to offer this woman? Just exactly what? A life of bad faith? Lived to the hilt? That's what? The ultimate in blood-sucking propriety? Don't you know who this woman is? Don't you realize what this woman has become? Don't you have any inkling of what she is in communion with? The perennial indictment of the middle class from somebody who did not exist. The celebration of his daughter's degradation and the excoriation of his class. Guilty. According to somebody who did not exist. You are going to take her away from me? You who fell sick when you saw her? Sick because she refuses to be captured in your shitty little moral universe? Tell me, sweet, how did you get so smart? He hung up. Dawn has Orcutt. I have Sheila. Mary has Rita, or she doesn't have Rita. Can Rita stay for dinner? Can Rita stay overnight? Can Rita wear my boots? Mom, can you drive me and Rita to the village? And my father drops dead. If it has to be, it has to be. He got over his father's dying. I'll get over my father's dying. I'll get over everything. I do not care what meaning it has or what meaning it doesn't have, whether it fits or whether it doesn't fit. They are not dealing with me anymore. I don't exist. They are dealing now with an irresponsible person. They are dealing with someone who does not care. Can Rita and I blow up the post office? Yes. Whatever you want, dear. And whoever dies, dies. Madness and provocation. Nothing recognizable. Nothing plausible. No context in which it hangs together. He no longer hangs together. Even his capacity for suffering no longer exists. A great idea takes hold of him. His capacity for suffering no longer exists. But that idea, however great, did not make it out of the room with him. Never should have hung up, never. She'd make him pay a huge price for that. 6'3", 46 years old, a multi-million dollar business, and broken for a second time by a ruthless, pint-sized slut. This is his enemy, and she does exist. But where did she come from? Why does she write me, phone, strike out at me? What does she have to do with my poor broken girl? Nothing. Once again, she leaves him soaked with sweat, his head a ringing globe of pain. The entire length of his body is suffused with a fatigue so extreme that it feels like the onset of death, and yet his enemy evinces little more substance than a mythical monster. Not a shadow enemy, exactly. Not nothing, but what then? A courier, yes. Does her number on him, indicts him, exploits him, eludes him, resists him, brings him to a total bewildered standstill by saying whatever mad words come into her head, encircles him in her lunatic clichés, and is in and out like a courier. But a courier from whom? From where? He knows nothing about her, except that she expresses perfectly the stupidity of her kind, except that he is still her villain, that her hatred of him is resolute, except that she's now 27, not a kid anymore, a woman, but grotesquely fixed in her position, behaves like a mechanism of human parts, like a loudspeaker, human parts assembled as a loudspeaker designed to produce shattering sound, a sound that is disruptive and maddening. After 5 years, the change is only in the direction of more of the same sound. The deterioration of Mary comes as Jainism. The deterioration of Rita Cohen comes as more. He knows nothing about her except that she needs more than ever to be in charge, to be more and more and more unexpected. He knows he's dealing with an unbending destroyer, with something big and someone very small. 5 years have passed. Rita is back. Something is up. Something unimaginable is about to happen again. He would never get across the line that was tonight. Ever since leaving Mary in that cell, behind that veil, he has known that he is no longer a man who can endlessly forestall being crushed. I am done with craving and selfhood, thanks to you. Someone opened the study door. Are you all right? It was Sheila Salzman. What do you want? She pulled the door shut behind her and came into the room. You looked ill at dinner. Now you look even worse. Over Don's desk was a framed photograph of Count. All the blue ribbons Count won were pinned to the wall on either side of the picture. It was the same picture of Count that used to appear in Don's annual ad in the Simmental Breeders magazine. Mary had been the one to choose the slogan for the ad from the three Don had proposed to them in the kitchen after dinner one night. Count can do wonderful things for your herd. If ever there was a bull to use, it's Count. A bull upon which a herd can be built. Mary at first argued for a suggestion of her own. You can count on Count. But after Dawn and the Swede each made the case against it, Mary chose a bull upon which a herd can be built. And that became the slogan for Arcady Breeders for as long as Count was Dawn's stylish superstar. On the desk, there used to be a snapshot of Mary, age 13, standing at the head of their long-bodied prize bull, the golden certified meat sire, holding him by a leather lead shank clipped into his nose ring. As a 4-H kid, she'd been taught how to lead and walk and wash and handle a bull, first a yearling, but then the big boys. And Dawn had taught her how to show Count, to hold her hand up on the strap so that his head was up, to keep a bit of the tension on the lead and move it a little with her hand, first so as to show Count off to advantage, but also to be in communication with him so that he'd listen a little more than he might if her hand was slack and down at her side. Even though Count wasn't difficult or arrogant, Dawn taught Mary never to trust him. He could sometimes have a strong attitude, even with Mary and Dawn, the two people he was most used to in the world. In just that photograph, a picture he loved in the same way he loved the picture that had appeared on page one of the Denville Randolph Courier of Dawn in her blazer at the fireplace mantel, he could see all that Dawn had patiently taught Mary and all that Mary had eagerly learned from her. But it was gone. As was the sentimental memento of Dawn's childhood. A photograph of the charming wooden bridge down at Spring Lake that led across the lake to St. Catherine's. A picture taken in the spring sunshine with the azaleas in bloom at either end of the bridge end, resplendent in the background, the weathered copper dome of the grand church itself, where, as a kid, she'd like to imagine herself a bride in a white bridal gown. All there was on Dawn's desk now was Orcutt's cardboard model. Is this the new house? Sheila asked him. You bitch. She did not move. She looked directly back at him, but did not speak or move. He could take Count's picture off the wall and bludgeon her over the head with it, and she would still be unruffled, still somehow deprive him of a heartfelt response. 5 years earlier, for 4 months, they had been lovers. Why tell him the truth now, if she was able to withhold it from him even then? Leave me alone, he said. But when she turned to do as he gruffly requested, he grabbed her arm and swung her flat against the closed door. You took her in. The force of the rage was in no way concealed by the whisper that rasped up from his throat. Her skull was locked between his hands. Her head had been held in his powerful grip before, but never, never like this. You took her in. Yes. You never told me. She did not answer. I could kill you, he said, and immediately upon saying it, let her go. You've seen her, Sheila said. Her hands neatly folded before her, that nonsensical calm, only moments after he had threatened to kill her. All that ridiculous self-control, always that ridiculous, careful, self-controlled thinking. You know everything, he snarled. I know what you've been through. What can be done for her? By you? Why did you let her go? She went to your house. She'd blown up a building. You knew all about it. Why didn't you call me, get in touch with me?
I didn't know about it. I found out later that night. But when she came to me, she was just beside herself. She was upset, and I didn't know why. I thought something had happened at home.
But you knew within the next few hours. How long was she with you? 2 days? 3 days?
Three. She left on the third day.
So you knew what happened.
I found out later. I couldn't believe it, but it was on television.
But she was in my house by then. I had already promised her that I would help her. And that there was no problem she could tell me that I couldn't keep to myself. She asked me to trust her. That was before I watched the news. How could I betray her then? I'd been her therapist. She'd been my client. I always wanted to do what was in her best interest. What was the alternative for her to get arrested?
Call me. That was the alternative. Call her father.
If you had gotten to me right then and there and said, she's safe, don't worry about it, and then not let her out of your sight.
She was a big girl. How could you not let her out of your sight?
You lock her in the house and you keep her there.
She's not an animal. She's not like a cat or a bird that you can keep in a cage. She was going to do whatever she was going to do. We had a trust, Seymour. And violating her trust at that point, I wanted her to know that there was someone in this world she could trust.
At that moment, trust was not what she needed. She needed me.
But I was sure that your house was where they'd be looking. What good was calling you? I couldn't drive her out here. I even started thinking they would know she would be at my house. All of a sudden, it seemed like it was the most obvious place for her to be. I started thinking, my phone was bugged. How could I call you?
You could have somehow made contact.
When she first came, she was agitated. Something had gone wrong. She was just yelling about the war and her family. I thought something terrible had happened at home. Something terrible had happened to her.
She wasn't the same, Seymour. Something very wrong had happened to that girl. She was talking as if she hated you so.
I couldn't imagine, but sometimes you start to believe the worst about people. I think maybe that's what I was trying to figure out when we were together.
What? What are you talking about?
Could there really be something wrong? Could there really be something that she was subjected to that could lead her to something like that? I was confused, too. I want you to know that I never really believed it, and I didn't want to believe it, but of course I had to wonder. Anybody would have.
And?
And?
Having had an affair with me, what the hell did you find out, having had your little affair with me?
That you're kind and compassionate. That you do just about everything you can to be an intelligent, decent person. Just as I would have imagined before she'd blown up that building, Seymour. Believe me. Please, I just wanted her to be safe. So I took her in and got her showered and clean and gave her a place to sleep. I really had no idea.
She blew up a building, Sheila! Somebody was killed. It was all over the goddamn television.
But I didn't know until I turned on the TV.
So at 6 o'clock at night, you knew. She was there for 3 days, and you do not contact me.
What good would it have done to contact you?
I'm her father!
You're her father, and she blew up a building. What good was it going to do bringing her back to you?
Don't you grasp what I'm saying? She's my daughter.
She's a very strong girl. Strong enough to look after herself in the world?
No.
Turning her over to you wasn't going to help any. She wasn't going to sit and eat her peas and mind her business. You don't go from blowing up a building to...
It was your duty to tell me that she came to your house.
I just thought that it would make it easier for them to find her. She'd come so far. She'd gotten so much stronger. I thought that she could make it on her own. She is a strong girl, Seymour.
She's a crazy girl.
She's troubled.
Oh, Christ. The father plays no role with the troubled daughter?
I'm sure he played plenty of a role. That was why I couldn't... I just thought something terrible had happened at home.
Something terrible happened at the general store.
But you should have seen her. She'd gotten so fat.
I should have seen her?
Where do you think she'd been? It was your responsibility to get in touch with her parents, not to let the child run off into nowhere.
She never needed me more. She never needed her father more. And you're telling me she never needed him less?
You made a terrible error. I hope you know it. A terrible, terrible error.
What could you have done for her then? What could anyone have done for her then?
I deserve to know. I had a right to know. She's a minor. She's my daughter. You had an obligation to get to me. My first obligation was to her. She was my client.
She was no longer your client. She had been my client.
A very special client. She'd come so far. My first obligation was to her. How could I violate her confidence?
The damage had already been done. I don't believe you're saying any of this. It's the law. What's the law? That you don't betray your client's confidence. There's another law, idiot. A law against committing murder. She was a fugitive from justice. Don't talk about it like that. Of course she ran. What else could she do? I thought that maybe she would turn herself in, but that she would do it in her own time, in her own way. And me? And her mother? Well, it killed me to see you. You saw me for 4 months. It killed you every day? Each time I thought that maybe it would make a difference if I let you know. But I didn't see what difference it would really make. It wouldn't change anything. You were already so broken. You are an inhuman bitch. There was nothing else I could do. She asked me not to tell. She asked me to trust her. I don't understand how you could be so short-sighted. I don't understand how you could be so taken in by a girl who was so obviously crazy. I know it's difficult to face. The whole thing is impossible to understand, but to try to pin it on me, to try to act like anything I could have done would have made a difference, it wouldn't have made a difference in her life. It wouldn't have made a difference in your life. She was running. There was no bringing her back there. She wasn't the same girl that she'd been. Something had gone wrong. I saw no point in bringing her back. She'd gotten so fat. Stop that! What difference does that make? I just thought she was so bad and so angry that something very bad must have gone on at home. That it was my fault. I didn't think that. We all have homes. That's where everything always goes wrong. So you took it on yourself to let this 16-year-old who had killed somebody run off into the night, alone, unprotected, knowing God knows what could happen to her. You're talking about her as if she were a defenseless girl. She is a defenseless girl. She was always a defenseless girl. Once she'd blown up the building, there's nothing that could have been done, Seymour. I would have betrayed her confidence, and what difference would it have made? I would have been with my daughter. I could have protected her from what happened to her. You don't know what has happened to her. You didn't see her the way I saw her today. She's completely crazy. I saw her today, Sheila. She's not fat anymore. She's a stick. A stick wearing a rag. She's in a room in Newark in the most awful situation imaginable. I cannot describe to you how she lives. If you had only told me, it would all be different. We wouldn't have had an affair. That's all that would have been different. Of course I knew you might be hurt. By what? By my having seen her. But to bring it all up again, I didn't know where she was. I didn't have any more information on it. That's the whole thing. She wasn't crazy. She was upset. She was angry, but she wasn't crazy. It's not crazy to blow up the general store. It's not crazy to make a bomb, to plant a bomb at the post office of the general store. I'm saying that at my house, she wasn't crazy. She'd already been crazy. You knew she'd been crazy. What if she went on to kill somebody else? Isn't that a bit of a responsibility? She did, you know. She did, Sheila. She killed 3 more people. What do you think of that? Don't say things just to torture me. I'm telling you something. She killed 3 more people. You could have prevented that. You're torturing me. You're trying to torture me. She killed 3 more people. And that was when he pulled the Count's picture off the wall and hurled it at her feet. But that didn't faze her. That seemed only to bring her under her own control again, acting the role of herself, without rage, without even a reaction, dignified, silent. She turned and left the room. What can be done for her? He was growling, and all the while down on his knees, carefully gathering together the shattered fragments of the glass and dumping them into Dawn's wastebasket. What can be done for her? What can be done for anyone? Nothing can be done. She was 16. 16 years old and completely crazy. She was a minor. She was my daughter. She blew up a building. She was a lunatic. You had no right to let her go. Without its glass, the picture of the immovable Count, he hung again over the desk. And then, as though listening to people unabatedly chattering on about something or other were the task assigned him by the forces of destiny, he returned from the savagery of where he'd been to the solid and orderly ludicrousness of a dinner party. That's what was left to hold him together, a dinner party. All there was for him to cling to, as the entire enterprise of his life continued careering toward destruction. A dinner party. To the candlelit terrace he duteously returned, while bearing within him everything that he could not understand. Dishes had been cleared, the salad eaten,
and the dessert served, fresh strawberry rhubarb pie from McPherson's. The suite saw that the guests had rearranged themselves for the last course. Orcutt, hiding still the vicious shit that he was behind the Hawaiian shirt and the raspberry trousers, had moved across the table and sat talking with the Umanovs, all of them amiable and laughing together now that Deep Throat was off the agenda. Deep Throat had never been the real subject anyway. Boiling away beneath Deep Throat was the far more disgusting and transgressive subject of Mary, of Sheila, of Shelley, of Orcutt and Dawn, of wantonness and betrayal and deception, of treachery and disunity among neighbors and friends, the subject of cruelty, the mockery of human integrity, every ethical obligation destroyed. That was the subject here tonight. The Swede's mother had come around to sit beside Dawn, who was talking with the Salzmans, and his father and Jesse were nowhere to be seen. Dawn asked, "Important?" "The Czech guy, the consul, the information I wanted. Where's my dad?" He waited for her to say, "Dead." But after she looked around, she mouthed only, "Don't know," and turned back to Shelley and Sheila. "Daddy left with Mrs. Orcutt," his mother whispered. "They went somewhere together, I think in the house." Orcutt came up to him. They were the same size, both big men, but the Swede had always been the stronger, going back to their 20s, to when Mary was born and the Lvovs moved out to Old Rimrock from their apartment on Elizabeth Avenue in Newark, and the newcomer had showed up for the Saturday morning touch football games back of Orcutt's house. Out there, just for the fun of it, to enjoy the fresh air and the feel of the ball and the camaraderie, to make some new friends, the Swede had not the slightest inclination to appear showy or superior, except when he simply had no choice. When Orcutt, who off the field had never been other than kind and considerate, began to use his hands more recklessly than the Swede considered sportsmanlike, in a way that the Swede considered cheap and irritating, for a pickup game the worst sort of behavior, even if Orcutt's team did happen to have fallen behind. After it had occurred for 2 weeks in a row, he decided the third week to do what he of course could have done at any time, to dump him. And so, near the end of the game, with a single swift maneuver, employing the other person's weight to do the damage, he managed at once to catch a long pass from Bucky Robinson and to make sure Orcutt was sprawled in the grass at his feet before he pranced away to pile on the score. Pranced away and thought, of all things, "I don't like being looked down on." The words that Dawn had used to decline joining the Orcutt family cemetery tour. He had not realized, not till he was speeding alone toward the goal line, how much Dawn's assailability had gotten to him, nor how unsettled he was by the remotest likelihood, a likelihood that, to her face, he had dismissed, of his wife's being ridiculed out here for growing up in Elizabeth, the daughter of an Irish plumber. When, after scoring, he turned around and saw Orcutt still on the ground, he thought, 200 years of Morris County history, flat on its ass. That'll teach you to look down on Dawn Lvov. Next time, you'll play the whole game on your ass, before trotting back up the field to see if Orcutt was all right. The Swede knew that once he got him on the floor of the terrace, he would have no difficulty in slamming Orcutt's head against the flagstones as many times as might be required to get him into that cemetery with his distinguished clan. Yes, something is wrong with this guy. There always was, and the Swede had known it all along. Knew it from those terrible paintings. Knew it from the reckless use of his hands in a backyard pickup game. Knew it even at the cemetery, when for one solid hour Orcutt got to goyishly regale a Jewish sightseer. Yes, big dissatisfaction there, right from the start. Dawn said it was art, modern art, when all the time baldly displayed on their living room wall was William Orcutt's dissatisfaction. But now he has my wife. Instead of that misfortune Jesse, he's got revamped and revitalized Miss New Jersey of 1949. Got it made, got it all now. The greedy, thieving son of a bitch. "Your father's a good man," Orcutt said. "Jesse doesn't usually get all this attention when she goes out. That's why she doesn't go out. He's a very generous man. He doesn't hold anything back, does he? Nothing left undisclosed. You get the whole person. Unguarded, unashamed, works himself up. It's wonderful, an amazing person, really. A huge presence, always himself. Coming from where I do, you have to envy all that." "Oh, I'll bet you do, you son of a bitch. Laugh at us, you fucker. Just keep laughing." "Where are they?" the Swede asked. He told her
There's only one way to eat a fresh piece of pie. That's sitting at a kitchen table with a nice cold glass of milk. I guess they're in the kitchen with the milk. Jessie's learning a lot more about making a glove than she may ever need to know, but that's all right, too. No harm in that. I hope you don't mind that I couldn't leave her home. We wouldn't want you to leave her home. You're all very understanding. I was looking at the model of your house, this we told him, in Dawn's study. But what he was looking at was a mole on the left side of Orcutt's face. A dark mole buried in the crease that ran from his nose to the corner of his mouth. Along with the snout nose, Orcutt had an ugly mole. Does she find the mole appealing? Does she kiss the mole? Doesn't she ever find this guy just a wee bit fat in the face? Or, when it comes to an upper-class old Rimrock boy, is she as unmindful of his looks, as unperturbed, as professionally detached as the whorehouse ladies over in Easton? Uh-oh, said Orcutt, amiably feigning how uncertain he was. Uses his hands when he plays football, wears those shirts, paints those paintings, fucks his neighbor's wife, and manages through it all to maintain himself as the ever-reasonable, unknowable man. All facade and subterfuge. He works so hard, Dawn said, at being one-dimensional. Up top, the gentleman. Underneath, the rat. Drink, the devil that lurks in his wife. Lust and rivalry, the devil's lurking in him. Sealed and civilized and predatory. To reinforce the genealogical aggression, the overpowering by origins, the aggression of scrupulous manners, the humane environmentalist and the calculating predator, protecting what he has by birthright and taking surreptitiously what he doesn't have. The civilized savagery of William Orcutt, his civilized form of animal behavior. I prefer the cows. It's supposed to be seen after dinner. With the spiel, Orcutt said. Did it make any sense without the spiel, he asked. I wouldn't think so. But of course, being unknowable is the goal. Then you move instrumentally through life, appropriating the beautiful wives. In the kitchen, he should have hit those two over the head with a skillet. It did, a lot, the Swede said. And then, as he could never stop himself from doing with Orcutt, he added, It's interesting. I get the idea now about the light. I get the idea of the light washing over those walls. It's going to be something to see. I think you're going to be very happy in it. Orcutt laughed. You mean? But the Swede had not heard his own error. He hadn't heard it because of the huge thought that had just come at him. What he should have done and failed to do. He should have overpowered her. He should not have left her there. Jerry was right. Drive to Newark. Leave immediately. Take Barry. The two of them could subdue her and bring her back in the car to old Rimrock. And if Rita Cohen is there, I'll kill her. If she is anywhere near my daughter, I'll pour gasoline all over that hair and set the little cunt on fire. Destroying my daughter, showing me her pussy, destroying my child. There's the meaning. They are destroying her for the pleasure of destroying her. Take Sheila. Calm down. Take Sheila to Newark. Mary listens to Sheila. Sheila will talk to her and get her out of that room. Leave it to our visiting intellectual to get everything wrong. The complacent rudeness with which he plays the old French game of beating up on the bourgeoisie. Orcutt was confiding to the Swede his amusement with Marcia's posturing. It's to her credit, I suppose, that she doesn't defer to the regulation dinner party discipline of not saying anything about anything. But still, it's amazing, constantly amazes me, how emptiness always goes with cleverness. She hasn't the faintest idea, really, of what she's talking about. Know what my father used to say? All brains and no intelligence. The smarter, the stupider. Applies. Not Dawn? No. Dawn wanted nothing further to do with their catastrophe. She was just biding her time with him until the house was built. Go and do it yourself. Get back in the fucking car and get her. Do you love her or don't you love her? You're acceding to her the way you acceded to your father, the way you have acceded to everything in your life. You're afraid of letting the beast out of the bag. Quite a critique she's made of decorum. You keep yourself a secret you don't choose ever. But how could he bring Mary home now, tonight, in that veil with his father here? If his father were to see her, he'd expire on the spot. To where else, then? Where could he take her? Could the two of them go live in Puerto Rico? Dawn wouldn't care where he went. as long as she had her Orcutt. He had to get her before she again set foot in that underpass. Forget Rita Cohn. Forget the inhuman idiot Sheila Salzman. Forget Orcutt. It doesn't matter. Find a place for Mary to live where there is not that underpass. That